Okay, well, you know, the topic racism in America in 30 minutes or less. I mean, really. The one thing that does give me hope is that we are continuing to lean into topics that nobody wants to talk about. So before we get started with the panel, well, let's introduce ourselves first. Go ahead.
Jack Romberg, rabbi at Temple Israel, and let me actually remind everybody, if you don't know, that this Sunday on March the 4th is the Jewish Food and Cultural Festival. We begin at 10:30, and if you want to have your sandwiches, you better get there before 1 o'clock, unless you pre-ordered.
Father Tim, Co-Cathedral of St. Thomas More.
Pastor Betsy from Good Samaritan United Methodist Church.
Josh Hall with First Baptist Church, Tallahassee.
And Derek McGee, pastor of Bible-Based Church.
Right. So as I said, I'm glad that we were going to have this conversation. We need to have it often. So the very first thing I'm going to ask everybody to consider, and you don't have to say the number, but this is my question. How comfortable are you talking about race? On a scale between 0 and 5, 0, rather not, 1, very uncomfortable, 2, usually uncomfortable, 3, sometimes uncomfortable, 4, usually comfortable, 5, oh, very comfortable. On a scale of 0 to 5, how comfortable are any of us about talking about race?
5.
All right. 5? All right.
Are you asking us?
Yeah.
I'd give it a 5.
5.
5. Okay, so I'll be honest. I'm going to say 3. I'm comfortable starting the conversation, but conversations that are honest and deep generally don't go very long. And they end in a Twitter. Well, I don't mean a tweet. I mean like a giggle. So I'm going to start today with just a quote from Michelle Alexander, who wrote a book called The New Jim Crow. And we'll talk a little bit about that. She says, a new social consensus must be forged about race and the role of race in defining the basic structure of our society, if we ever hope to abolish the new Jim Crow. This new consensus must begin with dialogue, a conversation that fosters a critical consciousness, a key prerequisite to effective social action. This book is an attempt to ensure that the conversation does not end with nervous laughter. So my next question for the audience again, I won't ask you to raise your hand because you may not want to do that. Who in this room knows what the new Jim Crow is? You're raising your hands? Okay. Okay, good. All right. So I'm going to ask the panel, what do you understand that the new Jim Crow is, and how do you address it in 3 sentences?
So, prison industrial complex. It is the mass incarceration of African Americans in America. The disenfranchisement of the amount of minorities that are in our penitentiary system, particularly male blacks. And the argument that's made, first of all, I'll tell anyone and everyone in here, you definitely need to get a copy of the book and read it. It is worth the read. No matter where you are ideology-wise, the book definitely challenges your way of thinking. I will strongly implore you in that regard. But it's one of those situations where it forces you to look at our penitentiary system and look at what goes on in there, and ask yourself the question, are we actually rehabilitating individuals in prison and then bringing them out to be better citizens? Are we actually making them greater monsters in there and assuming and hoping and convincing ourselves that when they come out, they are better? And that's the ultimate question that has to be considered in that regard. When a person gets discharged from prison and you basically give them $100 and put them on a bus and tell them, have at it, you know, these individuals now have learned how to survive inside the prison. And I'm in no way discrediting why they got there, but that is part of it.
What do you understand about the new Jim Crow?
I don't think there's anything I can add to that.
Okay. Anybody else?
I would have said, you know, kind of what Derek is, because I've seen a lot of the statistics in terms of the amount, not just the amount of African Americans convicted, but the length of the convictions compared to similar cases of whites. The lengths of the convictions are significantly longer, and that's statistically proven.
Okay, so what do we understand about the original Jim Crow, if this is the new Jim Crow?
You talk about the systemized laws post that sort of fostered and maintained segregation. Is that what we're asking about here? Okay.
So I'm the moderator, but I have to say one of the primary problems about mass incarceration is that even when prisoners who have fulfilled their commitment to society are released, they are not allowed to vote. So one of the primary things of Jim Crow was this blocking of the voting booth. This is still happening. I think that this conversation on racism is important because we don't really even know what we're talking about. All right, so comment.
I would just add into that regard, for those who don't know, so there has been a petition circulating from a gentleman in Orlando who actually is supposed to be on the ballot in 2018. And the question is being asked, should individuals be able to get their rights restored? Many of the states, including the state of Georgia, once you're released, you basically get it restored. One of the arguments, and I'm not arguing for it, one of the arguments that's made, talking about the original Jim Crow, is many believe the reason why people don't get their rights restored is because it actually benefits one side of the aisle over the other. And so it becomes that big situation. But Jim Crow's way of doing things, the original Jim Crow, was to keep minorities, particularly blacks, from ever being able to stand on their own two feet, never be independent, never be able to establish anything and everything. The new Jim Crow argues that blacks started making progress. And so now, because they started making progress, now we got to find a way to get them back on their knees, begging independent. So now what you do is, as Jack mentioned, now you look at the comparison between blacks and others, and you realize that blacks are getting longer sentences for the same, if not lesser, crimes in that regard.
And several months ago, Audrey and I were up visiting my brother in Greensboro, North Carolina, and we went to the Civil Rights Museum there at the Woolworths, where the protests were made back in the early 1960s by the students who, you know, were protesting the that blacks had to eat and go to the counter at Woolworths separate from whites. And when you go through the museum, and you're taken through the museum by a guide, and they point out that the term Jim Crow ends up referring to all of the difficulties, even when technically, legally, anybody has the right to vote, but the impediments given to African-American populations in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, until things started to get straightened out a little better in the 60s. It refers to the whole idea of, separate but equal, that you don't have to have integrated schools as long as everybody is getting an education. But if you look at the pictures and you read about what the reality of schools that were simply for African Americans versus, the white schools, the books, the quality of the books, the quality of the material, the quality of the buildings that they were in, there was no equality there at all. All of that is referred to by the people going through that time as their Jim Crow. While technically it was, yes, you're getting the same thing, but in reality it was not. In reality it was not.
So has that really changed?
Well,
see,
I'm glad.
You all are so comfortable talking about racism.
I think, well, let me just, if I could make a comment on a couple of things that have been said. I think I agree with Derek about one of the problems with the correctional system in our country, and it's in, this doesn't just go for African Americans, it goes for anybody who's in prison, because I've worked in prisons too, and I've seen it, that there is no rehabilitation. And there is, I have a guy I know right now who is African American who's in prison right now, and he's excited because he's being trained and so on to do some work when he gets out and have some skills hopefully that can help him get a job. But there's nothing, the problem with this man, I used to visit him in jail every time he was arrested, and he would be bright-eyed and excited about the future and not want to be like his father who was in prison and his brother who's in prison, and he wanted to take care of his kids and get work, and I'd encourage him and so on. But as soon as he got out, he was the same person he was before he got thrown in jail. The jail didn't change him. And now he's in prison, and they're teaching him some kind of skills to do some work, and I hope that that helps him. But, I mean, I think a bigger question, too, is why is anybody committing crimes and doing drugs? Like, why is it in particular communities this is happening? And black, white, Hispanic, whatever, getting to the root issue of the problem. How about this question? What makes anybody valuable? What makes a human being valuable? Where does a human being derive its value? Because if we have the right answer to that question, then racism can't happen.
Amen. So another quote.
So hold on. Okay. All right. So yes, if we can answer that question correctly, then racism won't happen. But most people don't bother to answer that question correctly. Most people have a prejudice of some kind in their mind and their head. And I'll admit that I've gone through points in my life that I absolutely have had prejudices in my head. And we have to go through learning things in ways that move us to a different place. But your question before, Betsy, nobody has answered yet, which is, you know, have things changed? Or have things have changed, and in some ways they're better, and in some ways they're worse, because instead of some of the racism, instead of being obvious, it's more subtle. And because it's more subtle, the people who feel it, but then there are other people who say, oh, well, that's not really happening. But it is really happening. It is really happening. And there's... If you have not been in a situation in which you experience prejudice, it's hard to understand how somebody feels. I'm going to give an example. There was, several months ago, a whole thing about the Confederate flag. And that the mayor said in a conference down, or in a meeting he was with students in Tampa, that he saw Confederate flags in the back of trucks as he was driving, you know, to work. Okay, first of all, he was answering a student's question. Second of all, was it maybe a little dramatic? Yes. Okay, because probably he doesn't see it every day, because I see Confederate flags, but not every day. However, a Confederate flag, I think, and I have to ask my friend Derek to tell me if I'm right or wrong, a Confederate flag to an African American must feel like a Nazi flag feels to me. In which case, if you see it once, it hurts, because it makes you think of things that scare you, that upset you. I know that if I see a Nazi flag somewhere, it makes me shiver.
I'll just say this real quickly. To answer your question, you asked, has it gotten better? February 26th, our very own local paper had a story entitled, "In Leon County, Black Students Suspended Four Times More, 4.4 times more than white students." Yeah. The answer is it hasn't gotten any better. It's you made me mention subtle, Jack. I think it's more hidden. You cannot tell me that black students are doing greater things on campuses in the negative, and therefore they're getting suspended the more. I fail to believe it. I absolutely fail to believe that. But the fact of the matter is one of the things that makes it different is that some black kids, their parents don't have the money to hush the system. And that's just the reality of it all. If because of who I am, who my wife is, my kids get a different treatment in a positive at their school because they know who I am. I'm blessed to have contacts. I get that. But some of their same classmates don't have those contacts. And I see some of the same kids of different races doing the same exact thing. Treatment is totally different. There are more excuses, and there's more tolerances, so on and so forth. Let's be very clear here. The shooting in Parkland, 17 kids get killed. The young man does it. The first response to that young man doing it is they use mental health. They use mental health. If a black person did that same shooting, he would have been a thug. He'd have been a gangster. He'd have been out of his mind. You can look at any shooting whatsoever, we find a way to label it to soften the blow for one side over the other side, and it hasn't gotten any better. Yes, opportunities may have gotten better. We have a thing now called ban the box, where basically an employer can ask you up front, have you committed a crime? Take you through the whole interviewing process. At the end, they may or may not find out, make a decision. And that's great. Great initiative, so on and so forth. But ladies and gentlemen, they're going to find out. They're going to find out. I'm glad Jacksonville is doing it. Tallahassee does it now. But it hasn't gotten any better. Now, I'm not on the Bill Proctor way where Bill Proctor came out the other day. I'm not that far over. Trust me when I say I'm not. I'm not. Having said that, though, the fact of the matter is that we cannot be naive to assume that the treatment in Ox Bottom and Summerbrook is the same treatment in Appalachia Ridge. It is absolutely not. And what you don't find here is the superintendent hasn't come out and blatantly denied this is true. These are real numbers. These are real numbers. These are absolutely real numbers. My last piece is when Tim asks, why are people stealing? I will tell you, from a person who grew up impoverished, a mother who worked multiple jobs and still lived below the poverty level, I will tell you, when you are hungry and you don't have food to eat, you got a drug dealer down the street offering you, if you deliver a backpack for me, I'll give you money. When you are hungry, you will do things to feed that hunger, things that you normally would not do. And I will be honest to say, if I had stayed in California and I come to Tallahassee to go to college, I may be the one in prison. There are young people who all they've ever seen is crime. All they know is they have a job. They're going to be the next drug dealer in their family. That's all they know. That's all they know. It hasn't gotten any better. And the concern about racism in America is simply this, is that when I say I'm a five on this, I love having the conversation. Here is my problem. I have yet to meet a five on the other end of me who want to have the same conversation with me. So a five talking to a three can never get anywhere at all, because somebody's going to squirm. But when a five and a five talk, you can have real conversation and real change. And this is not about a Democrat or Republican. This is about, when I went to Africa in September, I never once felt that I was black. I never felt like it. I realized that I'm a nigger in America because I've been called a nigger in America. That's when I realized I was a nigger, was in America, where I was born. You can't send me back. I'm not from Africa. I wasn't born in Africa. I was born here. This is the reality of it all, ladies and gentlemen. It's blatant. It's here. It's also in our churches. It's also in our churches.
I'll add to, Derek, I have to add to what you said. I go on Facebook and go back a few months during the middle of the NFL season, and I see some people posting that the NFL players who were bending the knee, protesting, are being called thugs. Okay? Now, what do you call Ted Nugent? Okay?
Rockstar. Ted...
A rock star. Right.
No. Okay? Yes. Maybe a rock star. Ted Nugent, who said, I don't care what you think about President Obama's policies, that's irrelevant. But think about what Ted Nugent said about President Obama. He wanted him dead. Okay? What do we call Ted Nugent? Do we call him a thug? I would, but you want to know how many people don't, that admired him, that applauded for him?
So, I'm, again, very pleased that we're having this conversation. Nobody wants to. This is from the Teaching Hard History. This was from a magazine recently. I copied it. High school teachers and students are uncomfortable addressing the realities of slavery, and as a result, students are ignorant about this dark side of American history. In a multiple-choice survey of 1,000 high school seniors, only 8% gave the correct answer to a question about why the South seceded from the Union. It was to preserve slavery. The Southern Poverty Law Center has published a resource, if you're interested, called Teaching Hard History, American Slavery. This was a quote from NPR. Only 8% of the students understood anything about the cause of the Civil War. I was shocked. I was shocked. To add to your statistic, the suspension rates from 1972 to 2015 increased for white students from 3% to 5%, and for black students from 6% to 16%. So while the topic is not gun violence today, I think it is noteworthy to point out that the Black Caucus is very opposed to arming teachers, as so many of us are. But their reasons are because of their fear for black students. I'd love to hear something from you, Josh. What's on your mind?
Just random thoughts?
Yeah, what's on your mind? Yeah.
You got a question.
A question. What do you know about...
A pop quiz today instead of like a discussion.
Well, because I think that part of the issue is that as we don't know the reality of the world we live in. So this is what I want to ask you. And if you say nothing, I guess the point is made. What do you know about the war on drugs, crack cocaine versus powder cocaine?
As far as different, back to Jack's point of different sentencing, it's more common in one community than in another, right?
Yeah. So what do you make of that?
It would seem unfair.
Would it seem to you to be institutional racism?
Oh, of course.
Or systematic racism? Okay. What do we do? Tim?
Again, I think we got to answer the right questions. Where do we derive our value from? Let's look at culture. What does our culture offer people? Derek brought up the issue that some of these children are growing up and all they see is crime. I think that's a problem, right? I mean, what is our television? What is our music? What is the video games? What are the values in our schools that are being taught to students? What do we offer them as a culture today? I think if you look at it, I think it would be pretty hard to I wonder why they're turning to these things. And again, I think if we're going to be serious about this, the statistic you just gave about, what was this one?
It was suspension rates.
Right. You know, we can look at that and say, this is obviously racism, or is there just something happening? I mean, the number of, there's a large disparity also between out-of-wedlock births in the black community. That's not because of racism. It could be, in a sense, in the deep, deep, deep core of it. But there's something happening culturally in our neighborhoods, low income, perhaps, because this is the same. I bet if you took low income white neighborhoods, you'd have the exact same or very similar statistics in terms of kids who misbehave. So it's not a skin color thing. Perhaps the causes have something to do with that way back. But we have to address culture, too. Every day, every week when I drive back from the coast, and I would right at the corner of Orange and Crawfordville Highway, there was every other week there was a different billboard there with a different advertisement for a different concert, and clearly marketing towards a particular culture group in that area in South Monroe, and it was always some, guy who looked like a gangster, right? I mean, am I racist for saying that? I don't know, but that's what he looked like. If it was a white guy, I'd say the same thing. I didn't care who it was, but the guy had, he had gold teeth, or he was making some gesture, and he looked angry, and his name was there was dollar signs, or there was women around him, scantily clad, or whatever. This is the culture. Now, thank God, some Scott and Wallace bought the billboard. Now, that's what I see every week, okay? But every week I used to see that, and I used to think how, and I think this, we had a meeting a couple weeks ago that Derek and I were at, and there was a man there, an attorney there, who brought this up. He said, today's society with polarization, you can't have a middle ground piece. You can't say that Black Lives Matter and that maybe there's some reform that needs to happen within the black community as well. There's some problems there. I guess it is a problem that police are treating African Americans unfairly. That's absolutely a problem. Or that they're being sentenced unfairly. That's absolutely a problem. But it's also a problem that crimes are being committed. So we have to deal with both. And we can't just deal with one and pretend that one's going to go away. Absolutely, there's a problem with race and prejudice. But we can't just focus solely on that, too. We have to look at the core. What's really going on here in our culture? What are the values, again, that we're thumbs-upping and liking and paying for and supporting with our money? The hours that we spend watching TV, that's the culture we're being created. That's the culture that's creating these shootings. And I think it's also the culture that contributes to racism.
So I think, Tim, first of all, you brought up an important point. And the point is that economic status has a big role to play in how people are able to move forward. And there's been a lot of research done by this Putnam's book, Our Kids, affirms a lot of this that it does not matter if you are black, white, Hispanic, whatever, if you are in a low-income, poor economic area, your ability to rise up is going to be tremendously hindered. You are going to have a very, very hard time. Whereas if you are in a higher economic area, of course, you will have an easier time to push yourself forward. And it does not matter if you are African-American, Hispanic, white, whatever. If you have the resources, you will be able to push yourself forward. There is truth in that. But then there's another layer to it, which speaks to one of the illnesses in our culture. And the layer to it is harder for African-Americans and Hispanics to get themselves up, move up, because of the prejudice that is in the system and in so many people's hearts and minds that's against them. And I'm going to go back to something from the Bible, okay? If we just listen to it, we would be fine. This would be the value that we should embrace. It says 36 times in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, be kind to the stranger, for remember you were strangers in the land of Egypt. If we just did that, yes, we would be fine. But that's not the culture we're embracing.
Real quickly, before we go into the questions, I want to just say this real quickly. This is very important to me. So Tim was speaking his piece, and I could hear the chatter and the mumbling and the, oh my gosh. I have no problem with anything Tim just said. None whatsoever. And here is why. Because he has the right to say all of that, and I'd rather him say it versus the person who thinks it or anything. Absolutely correct. The billboards, I see them all myself. My wife will tell you. My son will tell you. If my son's pants drop below a certain level, I'm the first one on my son. Absolutely the first one on my son. I'm all about presentation, I'm all about that. But I think this is important. I think it's very, very important for us to understand a couple of things quickly before we go to questions. No matter how we think our country is, no matter how we think our country is, it's always interesting to me that we know how to find the population of people who will make us feel good about what we want to think about. I absolutely love having these conversations. I'm just as hard on my black friends as I am on my white friends. I talk about reverse racism, where blacks within our own race, we actually talk down upon ourselves. I talk about that as well. So it's not just in here, but my point is, something came up by Betsy that I think is important. There is a different conversation between racism and slavery. And no one wants to talk about slavery. But that is the actual conversation need to be had, because the truth be told, slavery lasts as long as it lasted because the white man was profiting financially on the backs of blacks. That is the fact of the matter. And so it was not going to end any sooner, because you're getting free labor on the backs of individuals. You're discarding individuals in that regard. You got to have that conversation. You can't ignore that conversation. The racism piece is, racism is a learned behavior. My son has a lot of friends. That's a learned behavior. But most of the kids have never even heard about race, about slavery. They don't want to talk about slavery. And that's, even today, we want to talk about slavery at all. And so the reason why Dr. Martin Luther King said the most segregated hour of the day is 11 a.m. on Sunday morning, because blacks will work with you Monday through Friday. But we're going to go to our own church because we trust our own people. Not saying that it's right or it's wrong. But there is a nervousness in that regard. When Trump won president, I have to say, when he won president, the fear isn't Trump. The fear is what Trump stands for and those who believe in that thought process. When a person can't take a knee without being called an SOB, without calling a thug, people are thinking about now, Kaepernick will never be able to play another down in football. He's been blackballed in football. But guess what? It's his right based on the Bill of Rights. He has the right to do this. Let's not forget why he did what he did. It was not against the president. It was against the treatment of blacks by law enforcement. That's why he did what he did. That conversation has changed. Now it's about disrespect and about the military. Not about the military. He respects America. What he's saying is, let's not forget about the conversation we need to have in America. That's all I'm saying.
I was at Candler with Dr. Teresa Fry Brown, brilliant African-American New Testament professor and preacher, and she gave me some backstory on that. She said the first time that he protested, he sat. And after that, he met with someone from the military and learned that when a comrade is down, you take a knee. right? And when you hand a flag, and I've done some of the military funerals over at the new cemetery, when you hand the mother or the remaining loved ones a flag of their country because they've lost someone, you take a knee. So he's actually moved to taking a knee as a respect for the military, a respect for the country, and protest. So I had not heard that before. Had you heard that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's just amazing to me. There's a desire to show respect and to voice the opinion that we're allowed to as the citizens.
I want to say one more thing. Can I say one more
thing? One more thing, and then I think we're going to do...
It's a story. It's a short story.
It's a story.
I said this, I think, a couple of years ago. Maybe many of you weren't here. My mom's here. She can testify to this. I grew up when I very young, going to elementary school. I lived in kind of a middle-income family, but in a neighborhood. But there was also neighborhoods in our zone that were low-income. And when I went to school, you know, my parents, my ancestors fought for the North in the Civil War. So I was born and taught that. That was a prideful thing for my family that we participated in that. My ancestors did. And so I would, you know, we did not, certainly my parents didn't raise me to be racist or anything. But now imagine, open your minds for a moment, as a young man, as a first grader, as a second grader, as a third grader, going to public school, and what I'm exposed to is the African-American children in my classes were troublemakers. And they stuck together, and they bullied me. And what was going through my head at that time? Like you have to be, you notice these things. So why is it these people act this way? Thank God, also in my neighborhood was an African American family whose son and I became best friends. Because that was the contrast that I needed for me at a young age to not become racist, but to see, okay, there's something different about these boys, but what is it? Well, they grow up in a different neighborhood, there's different cultures, different family. And this guy, why is he different? Well, because of his family. His father served in the military. And you can ask my mother. We lived at his house. He lived at mine. And so, but as to think about that, too, that's a reality. And yes, it is part. But this is not, like, this is the deeper issue here. This isn't, I didn't, you know, no one put these ideas in my head. I mean, I was in danger of becoming prejudiced in that way. And I remember having conversations with my parents, and I'd come home. Well, why are these kids picking on me? Why do they act this way? So it's a big issue. But we have to get deeper than just blaming. I know there is a history of slavery, but I had nothing to do with that. And I didn't deserve to be treated like that as a kid. And African Americans don't deserve to be treated poorly either. Right? We have to overcome this stuff somehow. There has to be some kind of healing and forgiveness and reconciliation for everybody. Right? We can't just live in the past, but we need to heal from the past too. We can't ignore it and pretend it didn't happen, but we have to heal and we have to forgive and we have to be reconciled. And yes, we have to eliminate racism and prejudice. I pray for it every single day at my masses.
Are you ready for us to... Okay, I just want one more quote. The civil rights movement in this country provides a wonderful illustration about moving forward. Against considerable resistance, the leaders of the civil rights movement held that the goal of the movement was not merely freedom from oppression, but redemption of the oppressor. They sought not to exact vengeance, but to move toward beloved community. King said that love was the most powerful force in the world. The movement, therefore, was conducted with the discipline of nonviolence. We know the story of the civil rights movement. I think that this concept of freeing the oppressor is really critically important. We want to live in a beloved community, so the hard stories have to be told, all of them. So... I'll share just one of my stories similar to his. I was bused into the inner city in San Francisco. My age, I was in sixth grade when busing started. And I was beat up several times by a gang of black girls that didn't want me there. We were moving into their turf. I ended up pretending I was sick almost every day, so I didn't have to go to school. And... finally, my parents figured out what was going on. It was a really terrible year. It was a terrible year. Well, I shared that story sitting next to an African-American district superintendent, Candace Lewis, a friend of mine. We were in Northern Ireland. We had to go all the way out of the country to have honest conversations with each other. I told that story, and she said, "I'm so sorry that happened to you." And I said, "Well, I know you weren't those girls. And she goes, no, I wasn't. And you weren't the white girl that did the same to me. And we hugged each other, and we healed from some pain from when I was about 11, and she was a little older later in life. But so thank you for sharing that story. These are realities. Would someone like to share a thought comment?
Suggest an alternative to the idea that single-family parents came about from culture, and maybe suggest that it was a Jim Crow law or rule that where welfare policies changed so that dual-parent families were no longer eligible for a certain level of support. And so the outcome of that is that, okay, one parent leaves so they can maintain the income they were getting, the supplement they were getting to feed their children. So on the question on this is, what is happening now with our proposed laws or policies that are similar or Jim Crow-like? What are some of the current, since we're in the legislative session, what are some of the current proposals out there for changing our laws that are Jim Crow-like?
Does anybody have a good answer for that? Somebody out in the congregation?
Are you asking, are any laws that they're trying to pass to reverse?
No, that supports
Jim Crow. Like a single mother gets more government money than a married...
More, that creates more Jim Crow feeling.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting that the out-of-wedlock births in any community has to do with policy and government and so on is encouraging that?
I'm suggesting there's a factor in that, yes.
Okay. What is being done to fix that? I don't know. I'm a priest. I hope something, but if you were to say like we don't want to encourage that, then how do we? I mean, then it becomes a difficult. What do we do with mothers who find themselves in that situation? At least from what I've experienced is, sadly, a lot of times it's not. At least from my experience, and this is just anecdotal, right? I don't have any statistics to back this up. At least what I've experienced is it's not the fact that the woman says get out of here, I want to make more money, but that the man doesn't take responsibility and he leaves. That's just been my experience. Not denying that what you're saying is true. There's some kind of economic advantage to it, perhaps. But, I mean, I don't know what's being done about that. But I would be concerned, too, about the people who find themselves in that situation, to penalize them.
Okay.
Got a bunch of people.
Thank you. So my name is Vicki Lopez, and 12 years ago, Governor Bush asked me to lead the work about people coming home from prison and how that would lead to a better life. And so for 12 years, I've devoted my life to both criminal and juvenile justice reform. I can tell you nothing has changed. I think the conversation you're having here today surrounding really what role does church play in that reentry journey. We found that people who had gone through a faith-based prison traditionally did better simply because they were connected to a faith-based community when they came home. But we also struggled with the fact that people who are supposed to have great faith, redemption, reconciliation, restorative justice, even in our houses of worship, did not accept people coming home from prison. And it just stunned me that we could all say we're either Christians or have a Judeo-Christian tradition, or even when we worked with the Muslim community, there was this, you know, we'll pray for them, but we don't want them in our pews with us. And honestly, if we can't start there, how are we expecting people in the community who do not have this tremendous faith that we are supposed to be, the, you know, light workers, the people who follow that love is the answer? And the one place where I realized the bias is because people didn't get to know people. In other words, they had this impression of, oh my gosh, black people are coming home. Oh gosh, what were they in for? And you're thinking, well, how's that relevant? I mean, they'll have served their sentence. Many of them, if not the vast majority of people, wanted to come home and do well, really wanted to be successful, wanted to put it behind them, but they needed help. And they needed jobs, and we, of course, didn't. We created an environment where you couldn't get a job. We create environments where you can't get housing. We create environments where you don't reconnect with your family, which is something so very critical for restorative justice. So I guess my question is, how do you all, faith workers, you know, deal with that within your own congregations?
Well, I have some actually experience first and then go on to, I don't want to call it theoretical, but another aspect. So specifically regarding release of prisoners, about 6-7 years ago, and Laura, you would remember this, there was a fellow released from prison who was Jewish, and he came to Tallahassee, started working at a very low-end job, and we accepted him in the congregation, and he became our greeter every Friday night at services. He would stand in the front hallway, and he would just welcome people to services. Then he got very active in our Jewish Food and Cultural Festival. He before he went to prison, he was actually
a nurse. Which is this Sunday.
Huh?
This Sunday.
Yeah. Well, actually, so let me finish the story. He before he went to prison, he was a nurse. And while he was, you know, in our congregation and working at, you know, jobs to earn minimum, you know, some money to pay his bills and get reestablished, he actually went back to do the education he needed to get recertified as a nurse. And he found a job down in Ocala. And about 3 years or so ago, he moved down to Ocala, but he still comes back every year to work at the festival. So chances are is I'll see him again on Sunday. So I think that that's an example of what we can be doing. But I think that that addresses the prison aspect. I think that as people who you know are faith leaders in synagogue and in churches, if we don't give the right messages from our pulpits about the approach that people should be taking in terms of racial matters, in terms of just prejudicial matters, in terms of, like I said, welcoming the stranger, okay, of embracing people who are different from ourselves. If we're not giving that message, and by the way, I know that people, my colleagues here have been doing it. Josh, you gave a sermon last, I know, after Charlottesville, that when you read to me what, you know, to us what you did, I was in awe of how beautiful it was, you know, and that's what we have to be doing. We have to be condemning prejudice in whatever form it is from our pulpit. If not, then we are afraid to be on the pulpit, and then we should not be.
And I'll add on real quickly, professionally and personally, I am a strong advocate for just a strong believer in it, try to engage in as much as I possibly can. From a pastoral standpoint, I'll tell you a funny story, but it's a true story. So we are through our outreach ministry, we've asked all of our parishioners who have a loved one incarcerated, give us their information. We want to start sending them handwritten letters each month, trying to see what their needs are, keeping them encouraged, so on and so forth. Gave them a person at the church to turn the information into, keep it confidential, things of that nature. This has been 2 months in the making. Been announcing this every Sunday for 2 months. As I sit here today, we receive not one person has responded to the request. And one of the reasons why is there is a familial embarrassment. There's an embarrassment to admit that somebody's incarcerated. But the fact of the matter is as a Christian, an unapologetic Christian, I preach a message of hope. All right? Preach a message of hope. It's hypocritical to preach a message of hope, and when somebody comes out, I basically tell them there is no hope for you to be restored. And that's basically what happened. Person serves their time, they get out. And even to the point now, we almost label them and say they have jailhouse religion, meaning that they basically found whatever they believe in when they were in jail. I don't care if they did find it in there. If that's what's going to maintain and uphold them, it's our responsibility. And what you will find all the time, and I'll do it mainly from the Black Congregational Church, what you will find is there is not a cooperation between the local churches and the Black community and our local jails or penitentiaries. And so what happens is you may go out there, you may do an outreach service at a prison, feel good about that service, and you leave. But you never did anything to give the people who are about to get released, give them a chance, say, you know what, when you get out, come to our church. We want to help you get back on your feet and things of that nature. And so what ends up happening is these people get out. Some people actually are in cities. They have no family there at all. They're housed in a different location. I've always said this. The faith-based community is doing a horrible job when it comes to living out what we're supposed to be doing.
I can tell you I'm praying for you. To pray for you means I can do that from a distance. To pray with you means I have to be in close contact with you. And that's when it becomes very nervous and very scary. But it's important to understand, as a Christian believer, there are many things in the Bible that points out to me when Jesus actually dealt with people who were the cast aside. The woman at the well, he dealt with her. And even the disciples said, why are you talking to her? We don't deal with Samaritans. He loved on her, the woman who got caught in act of adultery. He loved on her. He did things that were against that common culture. And today, we have to understand, if they're going to learn education in prison, they're going to know how to work jobs in prison, they're going to develop a faith in prison. They got to be able to have something when they get out to establish them. Otherwise, because it shows you they have a higher likelihood to go back in than they have to survive on their out. If they're connected to a community, it helps out. It's the scariest thing to think about. You preach love, you preach hope, but you won't live it out.
It's been several years.
Can I say just real fast, just in response? It's a great question. I do want to throw out, and I agree with Derek, that we all need to be doing a great job, right? And what I say is, when they say, why isn't the church doing this? Who's the church? You are. So, I mean, what have you done to help a convict out?
It's been several years since I read The New Jim Crow, but one of the things that surprised me in reading it that y'all haven't really addressed is the restrictions that were put on felons back in the 90s during Bill Clinton's tenure as president. When people get out of prison, if they are felons, they are not allowed to get food stamps, any sort of housing subsidy. They can't get grants to go to school. You have essentially boxed them in. And in that way, as much as keeping them from voting, you are, you know, putting them in a place where they can't succeed. The other thing that y'all haven't addressed is, I belong to the Citizens Against the Death Penalty. When you look at the people that are on death row right now, and our congregation, we're reading the book Just Mercy. If you have never read it, you should. Talking about the Equal Justice Initiative that was started in Georgia and Alabama, and how many people that are on death row actually very demonstrably are innocent. And because of the racism within the system, we met the other night to discuss it, and the thing that we kept coming back to was this was happening not in the 50s, not in the 60s. The book that we're reading talks about racism in the 90s. And how, with people who clearly are innocent, 15 people say, I was with him when the murder happened, and he's still sitting on death row. In fact, he was put on death row before he was ever tried, just to intimidate him. Those kinds of things are unforgivable, and I think are something that we've got to address, the injustice of all of it.
Yeah, no question. It's just more examples of the same things that we started to bring up before. I haven't read the book, so I don't know everything that's in the book. But yeah, I agree with you completely, Debbie. It just, you know, we've started to bring certain examples up. They're all examples of the same thing. All examples of the existence of a form of institutionalized racism. Of course. Yeah, but death penalty is a whole other conversation too.
Over there, we've got two hands up. Sorry.
Hang on a sec. We had one back here.
Rika first.
Hey, so I can't remember who said it, but we talked a little bit about this idea of slavery kind of being in the past and that tension of, okay, it's in the past, we need to focus on where we are, but we don't want to forget it. How do you live in that tension and decide that we've moved past it, especially when you mentioned, Pastor Betsy, that only 8% of high schoolers could answer why the South seceded? How do you decide not to stop talking about it? When does it just become history that we don't talk about anymore? Or do we decide that?
That's actually an aspect of something, I forget who brought it up to. I actually don't agree with that. I think you have to keep remembering what was. As the son of a survivor of the Holocaust, I don't want people to forget that the Holocaust happened. How can I expect my African-American friends and neighbors to have us forget about what's been their history, not just of slavery, but in all the oppression that happened after slavery? Okay, so I actually agree. We can't possibly make change if we don't know our history.
I think what I was trying to say, and I wouldn't disagree with what Jack said there, not to forget it, like erase it from history, but that I can't deal with Derek. We're not going to ever be able to meet as brothers and to be human beings together if this is, like, if he looks at me as a white man who, long time ago, my ancestors enslaved him, which didn't happen, but I guess white people did, right, enslaved his ancestors, and I can't look at him like, you're the same kids you beat me up when I was a kid because they associated me with it. I mean, we have to, at some point, there's got to be some deep healing. I'm not saying that we forget and just erase it from history, but we have to have some healing. And I'm not sure how to bring that about, but that's where we have to go.
So let's put it in a religious context. And I know in the church and in Judaism, we look at it in certain, and I think it's going to be similar. We have to be willing to do repentance, correct? We have to be willing to do repentance, and we have to also be willing to do forgiveness. If somebody comes to you truly repentant, okay, then you have to be willing to do forgiveness.
And I agree, we may not be the ones that enslaved others, but I have to admit that I'm still a beneficiary of my ancestors who did enslave other people. I am a beneficiary in the sense of the financial gain that was passed on little by little by little, the educational opportunities that were mine and not someone else's. And I know that for me to say that is hard and true, and I hope it's healing for Derek, healing for my friends that are tired of having people say, it's in the past, it wasn't me. Well, it was kind of my history that enslaved your people and from your history. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Shay Atkin, and I have more of a big picture question about all this, because a lot of this is just like putting Band-Aids on gaping wounds. I'm a trauma therapist by trade, and so I see this stuff on a daily basis. And my question is, with this oppositional energy that we're dealing with, a lot of times people know what they're against, they don't know what they're for, right? So living in that tension with us believing, hey, if we could all just be the change we wish to see in the world, great. You know, great. We all know the answers theoretically, right? But like, what are we doing practically, right? And so my question is kind of like with what Rico was saying, like, what do we do individually, corporately? We're talking about all this stuff, and we all know what we agree with and disagree with, but where is that true change going to take place to where we can be able to heal, but also remember and live in that tension as we walk out how to do this? You know, the racism, the slavery, like, how do we do this?
I think one thing that gives you some, maybe this is cynical, hopefully it's somewhat optimistic. I think we got to recognize that this is going to be a direction and not a destination. I mean, part of my view is that, you know, the world's not going to get all the way fixed and better until Jesus comes back. But until then, we've got to be pursuing that direction, okay? We've got to be moving in that direction. So that being the case, we've got to take steps, but it also recognizes that it's a long journey. Like, we didn't get here in a decade, and we're not going to fix it in a decade. So we've got to be willing to do the long, hard work. And to me, it's generational change. I think it's, if I go back and look at my parents' generation, or especially my grandparents' generation, and the stuff that I heard them say that I have never heard one of my peers say, okay? Because in that generation, there were ways that you talked about people that looked like Derek that in my generation, you know, you still have it, but you don't have it as frequently, okay? So I've got to then look to my kids and go, what am I instilling in them? And I think one of the common themes that I saw in some of the stories that were shared, and it goes back to an error that we see children make, and it's what we call overgeneralization. And it's, if I'm showing the three-year-old a picture of a dog, and then I show him a picture of a cat, and what do they say? Dog, or maybe not three-year-old, let's give him a little credit. One-year-old, or two-year-old, you know, they say dog because it's got four legs and it's furry. So that means, you know, they think that that's the same thing that they just saw. They haven't learned to distinguish No, each of these is different. And so I think what's important in the midst of this conversation and everything else, and probably preaching to the choir in here, but then when we're able to recognize, what is it, this person that beat me up, what is it about them? And Tim was saying this. What is it about them that led them to do that? And he had to learn to distinguish. It wasn't because they had darker skin than me. And that's what I heard Tim saying, is he learned to not overgeneralize. But if he hadn't had that friend, he would have been like any number of other people in our culture today who go, it's because of that dark skin, I've now overgeneralized, and anytime I see dark skin, that's what I'm thinking. Or to your friend who said, anytime I see white skin, that's what I'm thinking. I think we have to learn, and it's back to Imago Dei, it's learning to treat people as individuals. If someone does you wrong, that's who did you wrong, but I don't need to go rule out a whole group of people just because of that one person did.
Let me add to what Josh said. I think that there are some very, very practical things that we have to do. We have to be willing to have conversations where we do listen to each other's stories. If we start by listening to each other's stories without interrupting and saying, oh, but my story is, just listen to the other person. Take in what they're saying. Get to know them. Get to understand them.
So if we bring Greg Ellison, who's doing some amazing work on doing race workshops, where you get in the room and you start listening to each other's stories, he has actual experiments we would participate in. Would you all come back for something like that? All right. What? Everybody's invited.
But if there's bliss, the bliss is sad. If you look at Dillon Square, this has been trying. You've got to get uncomfortable. Individually, we have to do what we're afraid to do.
100%. So we have to go to Created Equal events.
So one more quick. We do it quick.
Okay.
We did that. My head has gone in so many different directions in all this conversation. What I've been dying to say is, what happened to us when we were children, we learned a song. I'm a Roman Catholic, but I learned this in Baptist Bible vacation school, something or other. Red and yellow, black and white, we are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. And I have seen children who don't have any knowledge of all this other dynamic get along so well. What happens? This is a systemic problem. It's not going to happen, like you said, it's not going to happen overnight. We have to do it in baby steps. We have to be reminded that the church is us. We are the church community, whatever your faith is. We have to do something. And the conversation in this room, we need a little more diversity in this population. We did get some of it. I don't know how many, I suspect that a lot of people here went to at the moon. There was a lot of very real conversation going on because that was Village Square. Thank you. That was great. We need to keep doing that. If you haven't gone to the longest table or had them in your home to do that, I encourage you to do that because it all starts with us. And then the other thing was, besides that red and yellow, black and white Bible school, was the thing that Martin Luther King said, and that is, we have to learn to live together as brothers or perish together as fools. That's not, couldn't be better said as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks for coming. I hope I'll see you again. And I would just encourage you not to be afraid, fear not, and meet people that look different from you and hear their stories.